we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Okay, here we are, episode 63 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. It's cold and it's wet. Lauren's sick. Mark, you're not too great. And Gabriel...
Hey, thanks. Yeah. You're not great either.
Yeah. Hey, you were... There you go. It's the old naproxen tablets you've got going again there. Is that right?
That's exactly right. You recognize it right off. You are sharp. We should do a little sound segment of this show. You know, it's like somebody makes a sound and you guess, and there it is. It's naproxen again.
I'm good at that. You drop a quarter. I know what it is. I'll be right there.
So, anybody got anything interesting going on at the moment?
Thanksgiving's right around the corner, so the three of us are getting our bird on.
Getting your bird on.
Hey, nice, Rick. Hey, and the question is the Rickatron at home now, or is he on his way home?
The Rickatron is at home, and then next, well, I guess tomorrow, I drive down to Cincinnati, which is the family, you know, zone, and then I'll be back. But man, I've had a small little brutal stretch, but sorry I couldn't make it last week.
Almost a rare sighting of the Rickatron in Columbus.
Yeah. Hey, so I have a question for you guys, because my US culture is not as good as it could be. So Thanksgiving, is it on a par with Christmas? Is it a really big deal? Is it a bigger deal than Christmas?
I'd say it almost is, for one big reason. It's not a religious holiday. Okay. So it truly applies to every, you know, effective American. And I like it because it's one of the few big holidays that you can actually go and wish someone a happy Thanksgiving and not have to worry about offending their background or how they celebrate it, because it's really just, no matter where you come from, what your situation is, you can really appreciate the situation you're at and maybe the good things, the bad things that need to be fixed and all. But to me, I'd say it's a real close one. The only difference would be in the Christmas example, you know, the different faiths as they come in. I think that might nudge it over the top for the majority. But for the broader, I'm waving my hand left to right, I think Thanksgiving has a better reach.
Oh, I'm pretty sure we can still offend somebody with our celebration of the conquering of an indigenous peoples.
Oh, yeah, but that too.
The thing that came to mind for me was Independence Day. And, you know, every time you guys celebrate Independence Day, I go off and sulk and get all offended at you. And no, I'm just kidding. Hey, on Thanksgiving, is it a one-day thing? Or will you take, like, the Friday off and then Monday as well, or what?
Oh, well, the thing about Thanksgiving is it's a gateway to the holiday season. You get a little taste around Halloween, and then Thanksgiving rolls up, and you have most people have an official 2 days off. It's always on a Thursday. Most people also have Friday off, and by now everybody just starts taking Wednesday off too, or you know, things really shut down. So it starts this big thing, right? And then the holidays start. So there's things every weekend, well, not every weekend, but you know, there's just all kinds of stuff going on then for the next month. And I don't know. Not everybody likes Christmas, right? Some people don't like it, but so Thanksgiving is the gateway for all that stuff that the Christmas holiday season is, whether you like it or not.
And it's what this Black Friday thing's all about as well,
The consumerism kickoff.
And it's arrived in the UK now.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so we've got Black Friday going on tomorrow, though. I don't doubt it's not going to be the kind of scale that you guys have.
Wait. You're going to have Black Friday tomorrow
on
Thursday?
No, maybe Friday.
Okay, thank you. Because then I'd say you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
We're actually doing our Thanksgiving today. So we decided we would just kind of play outside the norm, because there's a bunch. I'm on holiday right now. I'm over in Kauai in Hawaii. And we're there with a bunch of families, and we're all getting together later on today to have our Thanksgiving a day early, because people are flying back tomorrow. So tomorrow I'm going to go actually on a one-hour helicopter ride around the island.
Oh, nice.
That'll be my Thanksgiving.
Kauai is a nice island. That's a really nice, great place to go. My favorite of the Hawaiian islands.
Yeah, I was wondering about your pictures there, Gabe. That's legit, man. Enjoy it.
Yeah, no, I hadn't taken a really legit vacation in some time, and I figured we might as well do something with all these airline points and hotel points that I've gathered up over the last year or two.
So are you in Lihue, or are you in, yeah, the North Shore? Yeah.
No, I'm in Lihue. We were over in Hanalei yesterday, Poipu. We did this. I would totally I'll give these guys a plug, Kipu Ranch. They have a it's the ranch owned by the Rice family, which was handed down from one of the Hawaiian queens. And
was it from Queen Lililukalani?
Oh, there you go. Ricketts, my gosh.
Yes.
And then King Kamehameha. Heck yes. Yeah, man.
You're pulling out your vowel, your consonant knowledge.
I can't
pronounce these words. So yeah, but anyway, so it's like they have this thing where it's like you can go out on this like 4-hour, you know, 4-person ATV tour where you go around and see where all the different movie film sets were. We were at the place where the, you know, Indiana Jones slides down into the river and there's a rope swing and there's waterfalls, and you know, we spent like half a day doing that, and it was a really total worthwhile adventure. So I would give the Kipu Ranch people a nice plug because it was definitely a good family experience. And really cool because it's so beautiful over here. I mean, it's just you're going through these giant, like, kind of volcanic cliffs and mountains, and then there's these long, stretched-out plains, and you recognize all these things from movies like Jurassic Park and Indiana Jones and a bunch of other movies they filmed over here, and you can see why it's such a popular place. And then, obviously, you get to get on island time, which means all things slow down at a glacial pace.
Man, it sounds awesome.
It's a great place to visit. Yeah,
and I've done no work at all, which has been amazing.
But you're on the podcast.
I don't know if that's so amazing.
I hope work's not listening. Wait, yeah. You're on holiday, so you're good.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some tech news from the week then. So, you know what? It's back up hell if you're a VMware customer at the moment, because their change block tracking stuff is busted in the latest version, I think, of vSphere. Not great. We'll come to that one.
It's been broken for a while, hasn't it?
Well,
we'll come to that in a second, Rick. What else have we got? Oh, dear. More woes for OpenStack as The Guardian go up on stage at the AWS Summit in London, saying that they've had pretty much enough of OpenStack and are going all in on AWS. And then one last piece in tech news. In storage news, NetApp FAS arrays finally show up to the inline dedupe party. So that's all we've got in the tech news for this week. But I think actually three really interesting stories. So, Rick, I cut you off there. What do you want to say about this vSphere change block tracking shenanigans, really? Because my understanding is at least the bug was reported at least a week ago and it's not fixed. And let me just say, so this is my opinion of it, right? So change block tracking in VMware allows you to do more space efficient backups, right? And so I guess if you're running a tight shop and you don't have like huge backup windows, you know, not a lot of slack there, maybe you're short on tapes or your disk pools or whatever it is, you've not got a lot of space. What do you do in a situation like that? And you know what? Correct me if I've misunderstood any of that there.
No, you're right on the same path. And, you know, probably among this crowd, I'm probably dealing with this one the most. So, you know, my role, guys, you know, the framework that change block tracking is part of is something called the vSphere APIs for data protection a la backup. And basically the thought is when you go to move data in the course of a backup, there's a phenomena that you have called snap and scan, which is take a look at the geometry of the virtual disk and move what you need to move. Now, take the first full backup. Not really applicable in the most generic of sense because you have to read the whole thing. You have to move a lot of data. Really, in almost any situation, that happens. And there's a lot of products that use that framework. vSphere APIs for data protection, even VMware's own product uses that. My product at Veeam uses it too. The changed block tracking technology really helps you for incremental backups. So a little bit of history that came in vSphere 4. And the first of these types of bugs were discovered in vSphere 5.5 a while ago. Okay, and it was fixed via a hotfix, update KB type of thing. Update manager customers would have dropped it in no problem. A lot of backup vendors, Veeam included, once we issued our own hotfix, which determined if a workload would have been eligible for that, we actually then insisted on an active full backup to kind of mitigate that, right?
Well, that kind of sucks, right, doesn't it, if you're a customer? Because an active full backup is going to take like loads longer and consume loads more space, whether that be disc or tape, the network.
The big thing is time, though. You don't want that VMware snapshot open long, and that's the real kick in the groin there. So, but again, you know, I'd rather deal with that than a situation around unrecoverable data.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
But this is a biggie, right?
Well,
it's not lost data, and I get that, right? But that has a potential risk to the business. So let's say I spend most of Saturday doing full backups on the estate, and maybe encroaches into Sunday, depends on your business, whoever you are, yeah? But then for the rest of the week, I want to do these block-based incrementals. And if I can't do that, and I can't complete a backup of a system each night, then surely I'm at far more of a risk that if I have, you know, a problem with a particular virtual machine or server, or, hell, wider across the estate, I've then got to go back all the way to my last full backup, which is probably at the weekend.
Yeah, good. It could be bad. Now, you know, there's a couple of ways of looking at it. One, honestly, not everybody's doing these image-based backups. But for those who are, the right thing to do is somehow ensure that your data is recoverable. Now, there's a lot of situations where the change block tracking bug, as it's prescribed, would not have applied. So it's not like every single VMware installation who's doing change block tracking was at risk for that. So be very clear about that. But the big thing is to know that your data is recoverable. So I don't remember the approximated number, but it was not like it was very blanket. Every single customer would have been eligible for this. But it's one of those things that if you had a way of testing your backups, you would be in the best situation. But the vSphere 6 one was particularly nasty because it's been around since GA, even through update 1. So it's been around for a while. It was now just. So there were two separate bugs, one for 5.5, one for 6. So it's pretty significant. But I think just today, I saw it on Twitter, just today, a patch from VMware have come out.
Okay, fair play. Let me just step back a second and take a look at the wider picture. Go on, Mark.
No, I'm flabbergasted to, you know, I just kind of want to understand this since GA. I mean, this is something that was not caught in, it sounds like there was not caught in, obviously not caught in testing. It came out, it was identified right away. I mean,
hold on.
Been around for
yeah, long time, Gabe, since 5.5, the first iteration of this came out. But remember what I said. It's not every situation. So I don't know exactly the vSphere 6 situation, but the 5.5 situation, you had to start with a disk geometry of less than 128 gigabytes or something like that, and then cross over 128 gigabytes. You had to do something like that. I don't remember, but it was a very, very prescriptive scenario.
But is it easy for you to tell on a daily basis whether or not your backups have failed or not? Or is this something that's silent?
No, it's silent. Because
so that almost makes it worse then. It would not be easier and simpler if it was just clean cut saying, yeah, you know what, it's everybody, and then we can deal with it more cleanly.
Well, I mean, this is something that, you know, is near and dear to me, but the big takeaway is you got to test your backups. You got to ensure that what – you know, and this is actually a good example. I used to give this example – a long time ago, why people need to test the recovery of their backups. I'll give a Windows example, but this is actually the same problem underneath. What I mean is in Windows, if you're in the Windows registry and you accidentally delete a big chunk of the Windows registry, you're not going to know it's a problem until you reboot that server. But that server might have been up for months, but you might only keep 2 weeks of backups. Takeaway is you're screwed.
Oh, okay? Yeah.
This is the same type of thing where this problem isn't really manifested until you try to restore, but this is underneath, right? So these are – I got an old reason and a new reason of why people need to test their backups. I mean, this is what I do every day for a living. But in our podcast notes, I'll try to put the KB link here, this patch to address this.
I wonder what came out in 5.5 that might have messed this up. Maybe exam. Some rank speculation there in terms of the underlying storage aspects that might cause some of this change to some of the underlying infrastructure. I mean, the VADP stuff's been solid for a long time. I mean, and every backup vendor is relied on. So it's strange that for two full release cycles, it's been hosed
well,
to one extent or another.
aren't we saying it hasn't been solid for a while now, though? Is that not what we're saying here?
Up until 5.5, it
okay.
was,
yeah.
I mean, it had never been an issue, right?
Right, but you know what happened? Investments in new storage technologies, vSAN, virtual Bingo. Volumes, all those other things. Kind of go back a little bit. Remember storage vMotion. There was a whole big compatibility situation, right? Because VMware writes their own drivers for the storage. So it's kind of a full stack discussion, but there's a lot of things going on at the storage layer. And I hate to say it, but if this is the only thing that messed up, it's honestly not too bad.
It's a pretty big thing to mess up, though. I mean, the fundamental of your data integrity for backup and is a big one, given how large the backup software ecosystem is, and that you know the VMware products for backup are not very good. And I don't know them. So no, I'm talking about the things that VMware have created themselves, right?
Oh, okay, no comment.
Yeah, no, I'm not, exactly. But, you know, I mean, I think it puts an entire, a strong ecosystem partner for which there are a good dozen of companies or so that help generate revenue on VMware's behalf and do partnerships and events and all kinds of things like that. For them all have to, you know, jump through these hoops for such an extended period of time is a challenge. I mean, I remember talking with somebody, and I don't know how accurate this was, but something like 55% of the code base in 5.5 from 5.1 was storage related. That's a lot of information to inject into a new release. And, you know, it goes to the maturing process that it takes to, you know, make that leap from just plugging into other people's storage for the most part, or doing less complexity in the storage portion and trying to go out and do it yourself and encompass all the challenges associated with, because there's a lot of things and interdependencies that can break, and that's what I think you're starting to see.
Yeah, and you know, when they write the full stack, you know, this is one long-term difference, right? Windows, a lot of times, used to have the storage OEM create the drivers and the management software and all that, but to an extent, there's plugins with VMware, but it's a different framework because they've really written the OS and everything.
Yeah, but surely if they write and own the whole stack, isn't that like the Apple model of owning the hardware and writing the software? It should be easier for them to get it right.
And both Apple and VMware use their users as beta testers.
Harsh.
Well, and Microsoft's been doing it for decades. This is
really good.
This is a really juicy one, right? Because you can project this kind of thing into other virtualization spaces like containers, you know, like unikernels, you know, how do you keep this kind of thing from happening? What's really the deal here? I'm fascinated. My head is spinning thinking about what went on in the storage stuff in 5.5 that would cause this sort of thing to happen. It's kind of mind-boggling, right? Is it vVols? Is it vSANs? What stuff went on there? And it's crazy making.
Well, to give you some
tough, man.
It is, yeah. It is. But you know,
the more things you inject into it, I'm sorry, Rick. The more you bring on board, the more complex that system becomes, and the more complex it becomes, the more things can go wrong. With one small interdependency, breaks five or six other things. And so that's the same challenge that OpenStack has, and we'll talk about that. And some of these other systems do. You know, they try to do a lot of things, and they may do them minimally viable to a certain extent, but then they start to get deeper and deeper, and you start to put more and more of your systems on there, and it starts to scale larger, then things start to break. It works great in a three-host lab, right? You put 30 on there, it's a completely different story. It works great if I'm just dinking around with the little, you know, small VMs that I'm testing with. I start to put a virtual machine on there with a 2 terabyte volume attached to it, what happens?
Give it a little bit of history to, you know, VMware, and I'm a big fan, don't get me wrong, and what was the first thing I said? You know, you're not going to put yourself in this situation if you test your backups. Okay.
Who does that though, Rick? Who does that?
You'd be surprised how many do, but of course, a lot more don't than
every 6 months, man.
Yeah.
You should have a policy in place. I mean, this is a level 8. This is a layer 8 issue, right? Good IT practices beget, you know, knowledge of your systems, your infrastructure, and your where your processes fail. If you never test your backups, if you say, hey, you know, it's on the tape, the minute you bring that tape back, I guarantee you it's going to be the one tape that's corrupted.
No, I know, but it's a matter of having resources, having time, having budget to do that. It's really complicated.
But also, it sounds like, you know, you could test your backup. You could do restores. Everything would come out right. It's this change block information that you may not even test the recovery of, right? Is that something that you would normally test in a recovery?
No, that's a very good point, Mark. So Nigel's point, first of all, there are automated recovery verification techniques, and there are many of them in the industry. Okay?
But they take time, right?
It's automated. You do the backup, and then you immediately go verify that it's recoverable. And I don't want to pitch what I do, but I know that what I do does that, and there are a lot of other products that can do that now too. But what they do is they reconstitute the virtual machine. They don't just do a parity check left-right. They actually run it.
Yeah, I know. So you're running backups and you're writing to your dedupable storage pool, a data domain or whatever, right? And then suddenly you have to try and do one of those jobs and it's all read workload and it spins up a virtual machine or whatever it does and tests it. That makes the data domain perform like a dog. You can't do that in a busy data domain.
No, what I call the ultimate backup storage architecture is a mindset, an idea. And it doesn't involve the first stop being something like a dedupe appliance.
Right.
You need general purpose, primary class of storage, because when you do things like that, you need a performance.
Exactly. Yeah.
But the other thing I want to get at, guys, VMware has a track record of corrective action. And this is very important. What I mean by that is, Gabe, you might remember in the VMware 3.5 days, remember the HA bug that would shut everything down or something like that. They fixed it pretty quick. Remember in 2010 or 2009, the time bomb where the certificate expired, and then this flood of cases came in Australia because the certificate shut the host down or something like that. It was crazy, right? This thing as well, they have displayed evidence of very quick corrective action on this stuff. So, I mean, bugs like this happen to a lot of people, a lot of different software brands. You know, I used to go down and say that I hold VMware kind of to the same standard that I would hold a computer BIOS to, okay? I mean, that's really what they are to the data center. But when they do have something not go as expected, they do a good job of correcting it.
Yeah, so this patch is out. You know, it's released, and so it looks like they have corrected it. Dated November 26th, today's the 25th, but I guess Simon Sharwood reported on that, you know, in Australia. He's ahead of us.
Yeah, that's true. It's, 11:30 in the morning for those guys at the moment. Now, you know what? Just looking at the bigger picture of vSphere 6, okay, and I've got – actually, I don't have anything to back up what I'm going to say here. Back up. Hope you like what I did there. Don't have anything to back up what I'm going to say here. I do get the feeling that vSphere 6 has had a bit of a rough ride. You know, I've heard people say things like, you know, it's got more bugs than a cheap hotel in the jungle. It's not been the most stable of vSphere releases. Now, is that because it's becoming bloated? Is that because they're under more pressure from the cloud to deliver quickly and they're not testing as much? I mean, or am I on my own in thinking that vSphere 6 has not had the greatest reputation from a stability and a reliability perspective?
I know some people that are not happy, but they're corner cases, right? But, I mean, I personally think, well, okay, I'll go dog food with you guys. Home lab, vSphere 5.5. Work lab, vSphere 5.5. Other work lab vSphere 6. So, you know, 2 out of 3 in my professional practice are vSphere 5.5. And why have I waited? Well, you know, part of it was this, but secondly, part of it was, you know, that I didn't really need anything pushing me up, okay? But I in my those, especially the two labs where I kind of have a bigger say on things, I'm very much like the enterprise customer, not too cutting edge, but watching the edge of the knife. Okay, so I don't think it's too bad myself. I think that again, the corrective action is good. I can't think of any huge problem. There was, I think, an SSL certificate issue that came with update 1, and it was immediately corrected too. As I'm going by memory, that might have even been my product's bug. I don't know, but corrective action is the important thing, because, you know, private labs that are like one step ahead of production are where those types of things would happen, and that's where you need to do things like verifying backup, verifying everything before you roll it to production in one's own environment. Because when you think about the corner cases, you don't want to be in the corner. And that's where, you know, you give your own lab a kick. To Mark's point, the 3-host cluster is a lot different than the 30-host cluster, but
Gabriel's point, actually.
Oh, Gabe's point. Yeah. But I mean, it's one of those things that most enterprises, especially, which is, you know, where this product is targeted to, they are like an N-1. That's how they roll.
Okay. And like we said, all software has bugs. No getting around that. Corrective action is the important thing, I guess. And you know what? It makes the press because it's VMware and they're so good and they're so popular. So not being too harsh on them.
And it impacts pretty much the entire Earth.
World. Yeah, it does. Yeah. But they fixed it. There's a patch out. Let's move on. So can we talk about OpenStack, right? So here we go. The Amazon Web Services Summit in London and the guys from The Guardian get up on stage and basically call OpenStack, and I'm quoting here, a complete and total disaster. So they tried to implement OpenStack. So they, I think about 3 years ago, their hardware was up for renewal and they decided, right, we'll build our own OpenStack. And they were using Cisco UCS with NetApp storage plus Ubuntu and OpenStack, right? Didn't go very well. Complete and total disaster. So now they're deciding lock, stock, and to ship everything off to Amazon Web Services. Quoting again here, they're going to let Amazon do the hard work in future. It's horror story to horror story for OpenStack at the moment on the complexity front. And I'm really starting to get worried. Are we starting to see a trend, right, that there's so many of these kind of complex horror stories in the press that it's going to potentially put new customers off? Because I do get, right, that with each release of OpenStack, they're kind of getting the idea that they need to make things simpler and the tools are maturing and all that. So they're racing really hard to make it better. But are they racing against, you know, disaster? It's a bit harsh to call it disaster after disaster, right? But difficulty after difficulty in the press seems to be going at a more rapid pace than they're able to simplify and mature the tool sets. And I'm just wondering, you know, are we going to hit an inflection point somewhere where people are like, you know what, we were going to think about trying OpenStack, but based on what everybody else is saying about it, I don't think we'll bother. Why not just put everything into Amazon Web Services? Let them do the hard work for us.
Let's start with the first thing, right? You're at the AWS conference.
Oh, okay.
And you're showcasing,
you're
showcasing somebody who said, oh, the product B blows. Why don't you go dig a little deeper into what The Guardian actually did, right? If you go look at their Stackalytics commits, they didn't do a whole lot of work. They had one person working at OpenStack that actually contributed back. They didn't really contribute very much. Most of the stuff that they put up there was just emails and questions about stuff. And to be honest, how hard did they really try?
Two things, right? I mean, to deploy OpenStack, surely you don't have to be contributing back like masses of commits and things like that.
No.
That would put
more
people
off. But if you go look, read through a lot of the, I mean, if you read through the questions and some of the things, it looks like they, I think part of the problem, and I'm not trying to be like this OpenStack fanboy here, I think part of the problem is people look at it as a VMware replacement for their pets, right? And that's not what it is. This is a cattle-based solution. And if your workloads and what you're doing doesn't fall in line with that, if what you're doing in the line of business that you're trying to implement OpenStack private clouds for isn't similar to what people are putting into Amazon, then it's not going to work.
I do
it's
totally
not the
agree
right solution
that.
For you, right? And so I think that's part of the challenge, especially when you see some of these organizations that have tried and failed or they complain about how complex it was. I'm like, did you take your help desk people and turn them into your OpenStack people? Because I go and talk with a lot of customers. In fact, most of the people I'm talking to right now are people that are implementing OpenStack-based private clouds and being very successful at it because they've gone out and hired people or they've brought in people that have done it before. And they've created teams, and they understand the benefits and why they want to go down that route, not as just something to use as the wedge against their VMware license agreement.
The legacy application stack and the traditional application stack have no place in a cloud stack.
Exactly. I'm not putting Exchange or SharePoint, you know, into my OpenStack-enabled solution. I'm not using it for, you know, I'm not using containers for that stuff as well. The thing is, it's just like we all have these perceptions. It's like, oh, we just use, you know, it's a cloud. You turn it on and you run it. I mean, yeah, it's more complex. If you started working with this in 2012 and 2011, it was definitely a hell of a lot more complex than it was today, right? But to go out and, you know, if I, for every failure scenario I've seen, and there have been a couple high-profile articles, I could turn around and point you to something that's very large and, you know, very successful running OpenStack. I mean, just at the last summit, I mean, you know, NTT, FICO, GoDaddy. I mean, those are like, you know, three of the four super user awardees that have very large, complex private cloud solutions that have been very successful. There are people that are having good success with OpenStack. There are people that are not. And it really boils down to what they've identified to leverage it for and then how open they are with that discussion. Because I don't give a lot of credence to somebody who didn't really spend, looks like, a lot of time or a large team or effort in trying to get this to work and then going out to the AWS summit and crowing about how awesome AWS is. And I would do the same thing that somebody, if they went to the, you know, oh, we tried AWS and it sucked, and now we're at OpenStack Conference and we're a big, you know, it's take everything you hear from high-profile pimping as with a big, big grain of salt.
I get that, right? But there wasn't anybody, and never has been, I guess, at the OpenStack Summit getting up there and saying, hey, AWS or Azure is a total and complete disaster for us.
No, what they're getting up there and saying is that we've completely been locked into those systems and we can't get our data out without losing every dollar that we've ever generated in revenue. Because once you're in, you can't pull it out, right? So what you're seeing, and the things I hear on a daily basis is, hey, we're hemorrhaging money. Our bills are $400K a month to AWS. It's unsustainable. That's what I hear on a weekly basis. I hear lots of people say, hey, once we got in, we can't get anything out. Now we're screwed. It's the ultimate lock-in. We're never, you know, we're having to go back and re-architect our architecture, our infrastructure. We have all these different, you know, organizations, the shadow IT sprawl. You know, money is leaving the company. We have no control of the data. It is the big on-premises versus off-premises or public versus private cloud debate that's happening. And I think the part of the challenge there, I think, is that it can get away from you really quick. And next thing you know, hey, our mission-critical systems are running on AWS. We have no way to get that data out or migrate it back without massive significant downtime. How do we fix this?
Everyone should note that Gabe said on-premises, not on-premise. Thank you, Gabe.
Welcome.
There are some industries that are going to have an affinity for working in AWS. I think it makes sense to really differentiate now AWS maybe from Azure in this discussion, because I think these clouds are different enough that you would probably find that there would be some customers that would really see an affinity with Azure that might not with AWS and vice versa. AWS is doing a great job with media companies, right? And The Guardian obviously is a media company. And when you think about it, it's like, well, what do media companies have that, you know, would benefit them in an OpenStack world versus AWS? And what has AWS created, you know, maybe specifically for media stuff? And it kind of looks like AWS actually has a strategy around media. So they've got a lot of high profile media companies using it, right?
You have a lot of media companies with a lot of different business units that don't talk to each other, and there's no significant single umbrella IT organization that's top down driven. And
got it.
You know,
right.
Everybody's got their own budget. They run off. It's like, oh, I can't get this from IT, or there is no central structure, so I'm going to go to AWS and spin something up. And next thing you know, oh, we have an entire line of revenue that's $100 million run rate that's completely reliant on this, and now I'm stuck here.
And the content delivery for a media company is an outstanding example.
Scalable, flexible, easy to do.
Absolutely.
Like I said, though, once you get it up there, you're never pulling it out.
Well, you can say that, right? But maybe The Guardian doesn't care. And maybe the cost thing actually works out for The Guardian, right?
Yeah, I'm not bashing on for it. I mean, the thing is, I mean, it's horses for courses. And the thing is, if it works for you, all the more power to it. But I don't think it's an indictment of OpenStack.
I'd agree with that. I don't think it's an indictment of OpenStack, but it's interesting insofar as you could say AWS may be shutting the door on OpenStack for this type of business, that AWS may have created a sound enough infrastructure that works for these kinds of businesses that you would be kind of stupid to do on your own, because actually AWS does this really well. And it's almost – and it may be industry specific. Right. You know, because you could look at a business that has a Microsoft stack. And, you know, the fact is a lot of smaller businesses do, big businesses don't. Right. But, OK, can we put this stuff on an Azure? Can we put this stuff in Azure? Yes. You know, that's definitely where Microsoft's driving.
It's targeting of core competencies. Right. And some yes. clouds, some solutions have core competency that trumps others. And that's why the value prop is there. And that's why the money factor isn't a big issue. And I totally get that. I mean, you kind of have to.
Yeah, Rigatron said it. If you're talking about, you know, media, you're talking about content delivery, right? And Amazon works pretty well for that. If your business is around content delivery and you're a media company, that might be the way to go.
Here's an example.
Media company? I thought they were just like a scandal.
Newspaper.
Oh, I know, I'm kidding.
But here's an example that, you know, just my own company, we host our downloads, you know, the ISOs. We host those on Amazon, S3.
Yeah, easy and cheap.
So if this is all the case, and I do get this right, so what kind of verticals does OpenStack appeal to other than the service providers and people like that?
Well, look at the companies they've showcased. Telcos, large-scale web presence, so, you know, AT&T, you know, Verizon, the likes of that, NTT, those are all three big telecoms that are using it, yeah. Disney.
Netflix.
You have Netflix. Well, Netflix
is on AWS,
well, but they've,
they?
Yeah, Walmart Labs. Just to name a few, you know, FICO, which is a credit, you know, the credit service, GoDaddy, you know, big web presence organizations, a lot of software as a service type of implementations. Those tend to be, or IT as a service implementations, those tend to be the larger, more successful OpenStack customers. And I think you'll start to see a lot of that change too as more of the managed OpenStack wins come out from the likes of IBM, Cisco, and others who have taken on that managed OpenStack and pushed that into, or Platform 9, pushed that into the enterprise. I mean, I can't talk about some of these things, but I've seen very, very significant deals being worked in the, you know.
In the more traditional enterprises.
Yeah, you know, thousands of cores being managed OpenStack, you know, entities that are going forward because A, they didn't have the staff internally that could build it from ground up and run with it. And it's easy for them to look at it as a consumable of like, I pay $100 per core or per socket per month for my OpenStack cloud. And somebody manages and keeps it feeding and gets it all running for me. And my internal people come to me instead of Amazon.
What may be interesting about this is what Amazon is trying to do with its messaging here about who it sees as its competition, right? I'm not sure that I've seen them going after OpenStack for a long time. Is this something that's been going on for a while? Am I just blind? Or do you think they're actually turning their sights on OpenStack because they see it now as significant competition to them that they're trying to hold up examples of people that couldn't make it work?
It's getting mature enough to where it starts to, you know, for people who are doing on-premises private cloud, yeah. I think, you know, I mean, but the thing is, I mean, like it cuts into any of their margin, right? The more people that decide to keep it in on-site and not go into AWS, the lesser their surface becomes, or you know, their target potential expand.
Right,
you know,
it's a little bit subtle. It's a little bit subtle. It used to be go to the AWS cloud instead of doing it yourself. And if now this is becoming go to the AWS cloud instead of developing for OpenStack, that's a different message. I kind of wonder if that's what's going on because if it is, it does say something very interesting about OpenStack.
Right. It's not so much the they're going to try it and they'll be back.
I think there's a situational message here, Mark. I think Azure and Amazon are going at it for that traditional, you know, infrastructure OS app type of we can do it too, right? And I personally think Azure has a better story. But then on the right, you've got the cloud stack model, and honestly, the OpenStack versus AWS, Amazon's having that discussion too. So there's really two different messages, and I think it has to be situational because, you know, you cannot have that same conversation left and right on what thy cloud can do. So AWS is actually kind of interesting in that model because nobody's comparing OpenStack to Azure.
True.
But, you know, Amazon can hit both ways. So they're kind of the Deion Sanders of the cloud, right? They play football and basketball or baseball. Sorry, I messed that up. Maybe I'm off there, but you kind of see what I'm saying? Because I know Amazon and Azure are going at it like crazy, and then OpenStack and Amazon are going at it like crazy. But they're two different battles, two different messages, two different audiences, two different customers. And everything in between also has a fit for Azure and maybe something else, or for Amazon and maybe something else. Best example is content delivery or the Netflix model or the Dropbox model or the ShareFile model. You know, those things, Oxygen Cloud, right? They all kind of gone down their routes, but they are really good with Amazon in the middle without even thinking about left or right.
Well, yeah, and let's not discount Google as well with Diane Greene coming on board, right? Yeah, we'll segue into there, right? Because that's interesting that they brought her in, given her chops with VMware and where she brought it, right? Do you bring somebody in like Diane
to help you put a more, I guess, ecosystem-friendly face, somebody you relate to, and then to kind of spin up a true sales force to go out there and sell Google Web Services or cloud businesses. You know, it's interesting that that move happened at the same time that HP is basically dumped hybrid cloud and jumped on board in bed with Microsoft.
I don't think Google bringing Diane is a publicity stunt at all. I think they needed serious adult supervision for their business to try to capture enterprise business, right? They have been goofing off there. Let's just call it that. Not serious.
That's harsh.
No, I agree with that.
But it's also true, though.
It is.
I mean, they've not focused on it. I mean, how do you even know that Google has a cloud you can buy from? I mean, you don't hear anything about it. It gets mentioned with everybody else because it's Google, not because it's got a bunch of tier one customers that they talk about or that they push hard. And I mean, I work in the cloud space on a daily basis. Google rarely comes up.
I hear more about Amazon
and I hear more about, Microsoft.
You never hear Google talking about how they get Time Inc. to move their data centers to AWS. The Guardian, they don't have these big companies going to Google.
They don't market,
They don't have the customers.
It always goes back to our discussion around some of these things. What is your core competency as an organization? Google's obviously a search, and then they put their fingers in like 500,000 other pies. Maybe it's them deciding to leverage a leadership potential who's been and grown a platform as significant as VMware and got to the point that it was, where it got picked up. And, do they go after somebody like Diane because of her track record of success in order to turn this into something that becomes now a real business unit inside Google that they're looking to make money off of, not just a science experiment like Google Wave or Google Plus or any other half a dozen of Google products that have just kind of come and gone.
All right, let's go around the table. Let's add them up. How many people do you know that work at Google? Me, one.
None.
I know about a dozen.
I probably know four or five.
Those are pretty small numbers.
Right.
Besides Lewis Gray, you guys, are you counting Lewis?
Oh, that's two.
Oh, yeah, good.
Mr. Google Plus himself.
But there are a lot of people that work at Google. A lot of PhDs. Yeah. I just don't hang around with that crowd.
But what's interesting, though, is that there's not a lot of them that have been in the infrastructure industry, right? And so now you bring Diane, and the question is she going to bring? Is she going to find those people and help make that happen? We'll see.
Part of the problem is that Google doesn't know how to sell anything.
That's where I'm going, Gabe. My prediction is she's going to build a channel sales organization.
No. Diane is not a salesperson. She's a technology person.
That's my prediction, so it's wrong.
Well, you don't know. That's your well said. You might be right.
I'll be right that I'm wrong. Let's just agree with that.
No. Or maybe she can. But the thing is, obviously, she has the kind of connection to this industry where she can identify the kind of talent that she knows she has to bring in order to punch this up. I mean, I think, if I was to pull several of the people I work with and others that I know in the industry, I mean, Amazon is making a significant effort to reach out and recruit people on the sales side, the sales engineering side specifically. Now, I've been pinged several times. I know several other people I work with and other organizations people that I'm just friends with. I'm like, did you get pinged by Amazon too? And I'm like, they're like, yeah, they're making a constant and Microsoft as well.
That's it. Microsoft is the only big cloud other than HP who didn't work, who has a channel sales org.
Right.
Yeah. If Google was going to do that, though, they would maybe Diane will try to bring in Kirk Bowman, who built the channel for VMware in its early years. Diane didn't do that. It was Kirk who did that. But that's why I said that earlier, Rick.
The thing about Diane, though, right, is she's been on the board there at Google for quite a few years now. And one of the articles I read was quoting Google as saying, she's been on the board for, I think it was 3 or something years, focusing on making it easy to build and maintain enterprise applications. So she's already been working at it for, at least 3 years, and they still suck at it. So, and I know it's, being on the board's one thing and then running the entire group that looks after cloud platforms is different, but I don't know that I'm necessarily, I don't know that the future's that bright for her. I think it's a big old thing to try and tackle there at Google. They just don't do this stuff.
Boards are usually full of strong opinions, and maybe finally her opinion's winning out in light of the successes of their competitors.
And the other thing, right, is there's a new scrutiny on Google on how they're making money, right? And what about these various businesses? Are these things a science project, you know, that are just going to continue to be science projects, or do we have serious business here, right? And I
now
see
that we're
and
Alphabet.
I see,
you know,
exactly. Well, I see bringing Diane in, right, as somebody, okay, she's been on the board. It's been frustrating. It hasn't worked. Okay, if we're going to do something about it, we will bring in adult supervision and get this done, right? And now the question is whether or not she has the authority, the budget, and all that stuff to do what needs to be done.
Oh, they got money.
They've got money, but does she have it? And does she have the authority to make it happen, right? That's the question.
Well, the thing is, look at what's going on in the cloud space at the moment. If Google were to get this right and get their slice of the cloud pie right, that is a big old slice of pie, isn't it? I mean, they were talking in one of the articles that I read saying that in 5 years, and it's probably, you know, I'm sure they're making this up, right? But within 5 years, they were thinking the cloud platform business could be larger than the advertising business. And if you think about it, right, the advertising business brought in over $6 billion in the last quarter. So those are massive numbers, and that's a big slice of potential pie they could take, but I don't know if it's that big.
They should have quoted Mark Hurd from Oracle, who said, our cloud business is going to be huge.
Oh, that's right, yeah. It's going to be between Amazon Web Services and Oracle. That's right, yeah. No, but the thing is,
I mean, because Google...
I wouldn't count those guys out, though.
Because Google's enterprise business is about the same size as Oracle's business right now. Oracle's cloud business right now.
And they're both really, the bigger companies, both revenues are really based on one product.
Absolutely, yeah. Hey, Gabriel, did you say you would not count Oracle out of the cloud yet?
No, because I don't think they've even started to make their entrance into it. They've been slowly buying and building or bringing the pieces together to go that route. Look, they basically picked up all of the Nebula team. They've gone after other little bits and pieces here and there. I think it's one of those things where it's going to be, you know, in typical Oracle fashion, it will be a big splash when they're ready to release it. And, you know, you think about it, you know, how many people go to Oracle Open World? How many customers do they have? How much entrenchment do they have in that space? If they decided to go and provide a new model of consumption for their Oracle customers that they manage and control, they're the kings of making money.
You're right. Imagine a hyper-public cloud built specifically for the enterprise. Think of that.
To wring the cash out of their customers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or make it easier to transform the customer use model away from their, you know, on-site workloads and bring them someplace else. I mean, you know, we can speculate that's why the VirtuStream thing came onto EMC to get penetration into the SAP space, even though I think we had an item in our news thing about how that's kind of fallen apart. But, you know, if you want to capture a significant part of your market and get this longevity where things are moving more towards a public or hybrid cloud-based consumption model, then why not get out in front of it early?
Hey, so it's not a huge number, right? But I reckon I've spoken to 4 Oracle customers in the last 3 or 4 months. None of them would be interested in getting into bed with Oracle in the cloud. If they're going to make a move to the cloud, they want to do it with another partner. Now, whether or not they actually could do it with another partner and whether maybe they'd be strong-armed into doing it with Oracle, maybe is a different matter. But none of them actually want to. I will eat my hat, okay, if Oracle make it as a major cloud company. I will eat my hat.
Let's put that down. I think we should have a virtual brim or something of a cap with teeth marks in it.
Yeah.
And we'll keep that up as a reminder. That'll be a new avatar.
Yeah. But like Rick said earlier, I'm totally open to being wrong about that. But, man, I don't see it happening.
Me neither.
I'm an Oracle customer. They come in and say, you can have the same consumption that you have today, but at half the support price model. I'm going to do it tomorrow. Because you're running it on Oracle's cloud. And almost all their customers would.
And that is effectively what they're doing.
That's probably their play.
Yeah, that is their play at the moment.
Yeah, and it maintains their ownership of that space. Because there's a lot of other database solutions out there that have gotten stronger. And if I want to keep some of my customer base instead of losing it en masse, then I offer up a different way to do it. That's the reason why some of the storage companies have bought some hot ticket items that they're not really pushing super hard yet, because they're hedging their futures, or they're hedging their bets against the loss of those legacy systems, or the loss to cloud-based storage offerings.
You think about EMC, Gabriel?
Yes. Or I mean, or HP or anybody else out there. I mean, you know, you look at the direction. I mean, especially storage is, given as storage geeky as we are, a lot of storage companies out there today are kind of like, I think secretly they're kind of afraid of the cloud and cloud-based storage technologies because it's going to eat into their market so significantly. You know, they don't care about the small mom and pop stuff and, you know, the customer base that goes after a 3-2-1 or, you know, those SMB groups. It's the people who buy petabytes.
What happens if this DevOps thing really takes off and all the people that run infrastructure start, you know, working for the people that develop apps? What happens then?
Right.
It's the end for them.
Because, I mean, it gets a lot of lip service today, but it's, there's a, you know, there's sea change coming, or the wave is brewing, or a tsunami, or whatever you want to call it, where it's just a matter of time before it does happen. And do you position yourself a little ahead of the game and make sure that you have offerings, or at least it's something that's competitive? And we may call it lip service today towards EMCs or some of these larger organizations pushes towards open source. But it could just be part of a larger strategy where they foresee a need to either get in front of these losses that are impending. I mean, look at VMAX storage sales. You know, in fact, almost everybody, you know, in the storage space is going after companies who are looking to update their support contract on those platforms, saying, "Hey, look what I have."
Yeah, that is where the action is. Anybody that's, you know, you're looking for anybody that's trying to renew an old, you know, trying to thinking about a technology refresh, because customers are just bailing from what they have and going to something else. Right. That's the opportunity.
As they should. You know, there's changes, right? There's incredible new infrastructure options. The worst thing you can do is do the same thing you did before today.
Yeah.
Or because that's the workloads that the platforms or things you're designing today, you know, they just don't, those legacy systems are just not conducive to it. You know, they're just not agile enough. They don't scale well enough. They're not automated enough. All of those things play a big part for new types of workload consumption models and delivery models.
Okay, so let's take a quick break from all the technical discussion that we've been having now. It's a bit hardcore, a bit deep. We'll go to our new segment that we started last week, Hot or Not. So this week on Hot or Not, a company called Little Bits, you can go to their website, littlebits.cc. They're kind of like is it a Lego 2.0? Or in the States, did you guys ever have Meccano?
No. Is that a hamburger?
What is that? It was like little bits of plastic.
Is that anything like Vegemite?
No. Little bits of plastic that you could build cranes and trucks and cars with.
Erector set? We had erector.
Careful how you say that. Yeah, erector set.
I don't know. I've never heard of that.
Is your set erected?
Oh, please. Anyway, so Little Bits, I saw them at DockerCon.
Little cranes, so you can get them up.
This is a family show, guys. Come on.
It was. So Little Bits, right. I saw them at DockerCon. They had this thing up on the stage where they pulled some people out of the audience to build a kind of a crane to lift a container and then build a little car, and you can put a battery in it and it looked like a truck and it would carry the container to the train and stuff like that. Basically, it's kind of small modular parts that you can prototype and build toys and stuff with your kids, or you could prototype designs and things. To me, kind of Lego 2.0 almost. I thought it looked good. I know you guys have had a quick chance to look at the website. So let me just go around the table. I'm going to start with you, Rick, because I'm looking at you on my Skype screen. Little Bits, hot or not, and maybe 20 seconds on why.
Hot. I think that we got to have ways to get the little people thinking. You might hear the little guy in the background, right? I'd love to sit around, play with that type of stuff, and, you know, get a result. Something move, something go, something do the plan. I think it's hot.
Get the old creative juices going, yeah?
Yeah.
Cool. Gabriel, you're next, hot or not?
For parents, it's hot because of all the reasons Rick said, because we want our kids to get engaged in building things. For kids, it's not, because it's not Ninjago. It's not Lego, Fantasy, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings. There's no toy tie-in that gets kids, face it, that's what they're looking for, engaged enough. You know, I could put a Lego set with Lord of the Rings next to it, or Batman next to this entire thing, and they would go for that Lego set with the Batman stuff on there because that's what they identify with.
Great point. Mark, hot or not?
Not hot. Definitely cold as can be, because this is a science project business by definition. This business is going nowhere. It's too expensive. People got to lay out, you know, a couple hundred dollars for it. And then, you know, the examples that they give, track your laundry, you know, you put an alarm on your washing machine or dryer to tell you when your clothes are done. Not hot.
All right, there you go. Little bits.
Every kid wants to do laundry.
Yeah, fair point.
Nigel, what do you say?
I think it's hot, actually, but probably in line with what Gabriel was saying. I don't know how much my kids would like it. So I know if I was to sit down with them, you know, a bit of daddy time with them, then it would be hot, because anything that you do one-on-one with your kids and stuff, they just love that, right? But if I was to put it on the floor alongside all of their other toys and stuff, would they pick it up and play with it? I don't know. Are they going to put it on the Christmas list to Father Christmas? Probably not. So for adults, I think it's, I don't know, moderately hot, but maybe it's a bit of a fad. Not sure. So littlebits.cc, go check it out for yourself. I thought they looked kind of interesting. Certainly worth throwing out for the hot or not section.
Absolutely. That was a good one.
Let's get back to the news. So we'll quickly run through business news for the week, right? So we already mentioned Diane Greene, co-founder from VMware, appointed head of a new Google Cloud business as they apparently look to make their cloud business bigger than their ad business. Good luck on that. We also touched on HPE, that's what we call them now, HP Enterprise, partnering with Microsoft Azure for public and hybrid cloud offerings. And then on the Dell buying EMC front. So EMC and VMware shareholders apparently not happy, demanding changes to the buyout deal, including things like, pressures that look like they may be killing off the EMC plus VMware Virtustream joint venture. So that's the business news, and my mouth is as dry as the Sahara on Midsummer's Day.